Forces are locked in a battle with Palestinian militants in the southern Gaza Strip. Palestinian security officials tell the Associated Press that there have been casualties. South Korean media are reporting that one of Seoul's Navy vessels has come under a torpedo attack and that another South Korean ship fired on an unidentified vessel to the north. An investigation is underway into whether the North Korean government is involved. More than 100 South Korean sailors were on board at the time that their ship started sinking. There's no word yet on casualties. Updating numbers from Wall Street, the Dow is now up 51 points at 10,890, NASDAQ up 9 at 2406. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. On the Friday edition of Live and Local, we'll have several musicians playing live in our studio. First will be a return appearance by the band Bossa Nuevo, who play Urbana's Independent Media Center on Sunday. And we'll hear Denver-based singer-songwriter Dave Tamkin between gigs in Decatur and Palatine. Live and Local is your connection to local music and more, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This hour's interview comes from the Focus 580 archives, so that means that we'll not be taking calls. More than 100 years ago, people here in the United States, some of them, in fact, people in government, began to worry that American men were losing their virility. And so they decided that getting men in touch with their inner hunter would help. And so they created a new game animal for primarily urban men to pursue. And it's something that now can be found almost in every state in the nation. In fact, it can be found all over the world. And it gives us a good kind of case study to think about how it is our philosophies and ideas about the natural world often conflict with each other. The creature that we're talking about this morning is the rainbow trout. And it is the subject of a new book by our guest, Anders Halvorsen. The title is An Entirely Synthetic Fish. The subtitle, How Rainbow Trout Beguiled America and Overran the World. It's published by the Yale University Press. It's out now, and I'm sure if you're interested in fish and fishing, you'd find it interesting. But also, when you think about the impact of human beings on the environment and how sometimes some of the decisions we make have unintended consequences, that's really also a big part of the story as well. Our guest, Anders Halvorsen, is a journalist, has a PhD in ecology from Yale University, and he wrote this book with support from the National Science Foundation. He wrote it as a research associate at the University of Colorado's Center of the American West. Questions are certainly welcome as we talk. We just ask people to try to be brief so we can keep moving along, but to anybody who is listening can call in. If you're in Champaign, Urbana, the number is 333-9455. Toll free, if it would be long distance call, 800-222-9455. And you may also send us your comments by email and send that to will-talk, so that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Mr. Halvorsen, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. How widespread is the rainbow trout?
Well, there's a couple of ways to answer that. First of all, it's on every continent in the world, and it's been introduced, like you said, to every state in the country and every province in Canada and many of the states in Mexico, and incredible number of different countries. You know, you go to South Africa, they're talking about giving it the status of honorary indigenous fish, and in Malawi, there's postage stamps with it. New Zealand has stamps with it. And yet the fish actually began, it was native only to the Pacific Rim, from Mexico up around California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, up all the way around through Alaska and all the way to the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia. But it was just to a very narrow band there along the Pacific. And now it's been spread, like I say, everywhere. And it's become the sort of iconic fish. It's in everybody's notion of what a trout should look like.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that we'll talk about how it is that the rainbow, as we have come to know it, how this fish came about. Does the original rainbow, does it still exist?
Well, it would be tough to say exactly what the original rainbow is, to be honest with you. I hate to dodge the question in that way. But, you know, there's many different varieties and subspecies. And so, for example, you hear people talk about steelhead, which is the same species as the rainbow trout that you catch in your streams. But they're very different forms. And when they originally started raising these fish, they started mixing them all up. They mixed up the steelhead with varieties from the inland, with varieties from further south. So whatever that original rainbow trout was, if there was one, it was always a mix of many different species. And I guess the other answer is there are still many varieties of native trout along the Pacific Rim, some of which are in more trouble than others. You know, you hear about the steelhead being in trouble quite a bit, along with the Pacific salmon. So there's any number of different varieties, and many of them do still exist.
Let's go back and maybe talk a little bit about the about what was on the minds of people in America here. We're talking about sort of the late 19th century, where people were both, there was certainly concern about the environment, concern about what had been the impact of industrialization. But there also had been, it was this concern about, well, what this kind of life, changing ways of life meant for Americans, I suppose particularly for American men.
Yeah, it's such an amazing story. You know, you go back to the 19th century and the United States was undergoing this period of industrialization that had never been seen before, this incredible, unprecedented urbanization. People were moving to the cities, and the number of factories, logging, agriculture was impressive. And that had a couple of effects. For one thing, it meant that the streams were treated as unregulated sewers, essentially. So there was a great deal of pollution that was pouring into all of the streams, and that was really decimating the fisheries back east. And at the same time, you had an unprecedented amount of wealth being generated. And for the white Anglo-Saxon men who were running the country and had been running the country for up until that time, this was actually somewhat of a problem because they were ending up inside the office buildings. They weren't doing manual labor. They weren't in touch with that sort of primitive way of life that they had been used to. And there's just this amazing quote. Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who was the father of the famous Supreme Court justice, he wrote a column in one of the magazines of the day in which he said, quote, that such a set of black-coated, stiff-jointed, soft-muscled, paste-complexioned youth as we can boast in our Atlantic cities never before sprang from the loins of Anglo-Saxon lineage. And he wasn't alone. This was pervasive. Teddy Roosevelt famously warned of people committing race suicide. So the state of Vermont turned to a man named George Perkins Marsh, who was a very interesting man in many ways. He ended up as the ambassador to Italy. He wrote biographies of camels and a dictionary of Icelandic. But he wrote a report on how to restore the fisheries in Vermont. And his idea was that there was a new technology that had just really been rediscovered in France about 10 or 15 years earlier, which was how to actually propagate and raise fish in a hatchery. And it's actually a relatively simple process. You squeeze the eggs out of the female and the milt out of the male into a pan and then raise the fry and ultimately the fish in these raceways. And so what he proposed was that we needed to start. He says it was interesting. It was an era of laissez-faire capitalism, so nobody really believed that we could regulate industry. So the solution was not to regulate industry and clean up the streams. The solution was simply to stock them with fish that had been raised in hatcheries. That, he believed, would get us out, get American men, Anglo-Saxon men, out fishing again, and that would preserve their virility. He was concerned we'd become, quote, a duller and more effeminate nation. So that would preserve their virility, and that in turn was key to preserving our democracy.
I think that this is really fascinating that they would. I nothing against fishing. I'm sure that it's a fine sport, and I know you've done some fishing in your time yourself. That they would so much embrace this particular thing, though, as being a virility booster seems a little odd to me.
Well, there were two. The other one would be hunting. That would be the other obvious virility booster, right? Because they both involve capturing, killing, and physical activity. Fishing took off to a greater degree than hunting, partly because, as Marsh himself pointed out, it's a lot easier to get these fish into the streams. We can artificially propagate these fish and get them into the streams. Hunting is very difficult for a couple of reasons. First of all, the mammals that we would have been hunting, a lot of them had been decimated by this industrialization as well. But also there was a great deal of resistance to anything that was connected to the old world, to Europe, where Americans were still... They still remembered the American Revolution. That was still fresh in many people's memories. And in the old world, hunting was associated with an aristocracy that would go charging across the fields of the farmers, and oftentimes doing a great deal of damage to their crops. And so George Perkins Marsh wrote basically that hunting is not viable because we can't allow people to go charging across these fields. And we don't have the mammals to do it, but we do have fish, and we do have the technology to put these fish in the streams.
We have a caller here. Let's get to them, and maybe I'll just very quickly introduce again our guest, journalist Anders Halvorsen. He's a journalist. He's got a PhD in ecology from Yale, and with support from the National Science Foundation, he wrote this book. We're talking about an entirely synthetic fish. It is published by the Yale University Press. He wrote it as a research associate at the University of Colorado's Center of the American West. So questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email, too, by the way, if you'd like to do it like that, will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have someone calling from Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I went to University of Wyoming for a while, lived in Laramie. I just recently came back to Michigan. Now, you're talking about the rainbow trout. I want you to a question about the Skamania. I remember catching some Skamania when I lived in Michigan in the middle of June, and that particular subspecies was apparently introduced to the Michigan waters because it would run in the summertime. Did you and that Skamania, as I understand it, is originally from the Pacific Northwest strain called Skamania. Do I have that right?
You know, I haven't heard of that strain, but you're not talking about Tasmanian, are you?
I'm sorry, what?
There's a Tasmanian variety that I'm quite familiar with, but I'm not sure about that.
Nope, it's called Skamania in Michigan. I was under the impression that it's a rainbow trout that runs in the summer, and it did. I caught a beautiful Skamania in the middle of June on a little spinner, in the White River in central part of the lower peninsula of Michigan. And they seemed to run, and they actually clipped the adipose fin to identify them.
Well, I'm not surprised. You know, they have, like I say, they have any number of different varieties. So since we first captured these rainbow trout and started propagating them 100-plus years ago, they've been bred in the hatcheries, and they've, for any number of different characteristics, people really devoted a lot of time to trying to breed fish that maybe that fought harder.
Yeah.
They certainly created fish that breed at different times of year.
In the Rocky Mountain tributaries, or are they always from the Pacific Northwest area? Or California, I guess.
Say that again?
Yeah, you were kind of breaking up on us there.
I'm on a cell phone driving down the road.
Okay.
The rainbow trout, were they ever originally in the Rocky Mountain tributaries?
No, they did get up in some places a little ways into, I guess you could call it the Rocky Mountains, but in general, no, they were restricted all the way to only to the Pacific Rim. So they were not native to Colorado. They were not native to Utah. They're not native to Wyoming. But they've become so widely and accepted and stocked that actually they were Utah's state fish, official state fish for many years, and they were Colorado's unofficial state fish for many years. Up until 1994, Colorado, they were considered our state fish, and then finally we switched it over to actually to a native cutthroat, the greenback cutthroat.
Well, I hope that that gets at the questions, the call. I'm looking at some information here on my computer, and it looks to me like at least what this article that I'm looking at says is that a Skamania is essentially it's a kind of a steelhead.
Okay.
And that it is one that you that I guess you do see in the summertime.
Well, that makes sense. Like I say, they've got these the steelhead will spawn at different times, and then they've bred different rainbows to spawn at different times. So that makes sense to me.
Well, I want to thank the caller and again invite others to call in. Maybe also send us an email if you like, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. By the way, let me just, for people who are listening here, let me bring you up to speed on a news item that's just fairly recently come in. Something we've been following along has to do with state politics. Official results from the State Board of Elections now show that Senator Bill Brady has won the Republican nomination for Illinois governor by 193 votes. His fellow Senator Kirk Dillard now has to decide whether to concede the race or ask for a recount after the board voted this morning to declare the results from the February 2nd primary official. Dillard has said that he might seek a recount if he lost by fewer than 100 votes. He's expected to announce his decision at a news conference this afternoon. Dillard did not immediately concede the race on election night after it ended in a virtual tie. Unofficial election night results compiled by the Associated Press showed Brady with a lead of 420 votes. Absentee and provisional ballots counted since then narrowed the gap. So I'm sure that coming up at noon and in the noon hour of the afternoon magazine, we'll have an update on the story. But that's what we have on it for you right now. And again, our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Anders Halvorsen, and we are talking about his book, An Entirely Synthetic Fish, How Rainbow Trout Beguiled America and Overran the World. The book is published by the Yale University Press and is out now. The story here, I think what makes the story interesting is that there are a lot of interesting individuals here who have important roles to play. And so once, I guess you'd have to ask the question, well, once this decision was made that for the benefit of American men and for American democracy, we had to get them out there into the outdoors and doing things like hunting and fishing. Then there was this question, well, what are they going to fish for? Because the quality of the waters were so bad, things that were not good. So we had to have fish. We had to restock the water so people could go out there and fish. And then I suppose then the question is, well, okay, why the rainbow? Why not something else?
The rainbow turned out to be suited in many in a number of different ways, and I guess I'll even extend your conversation to the present day. Why rainbows are so popular?
Sure. Yeah.
First of all, the fisheries managers and the hatchery managers love rainbows because they're very easy to raise in hatcheries. For whatever reason, they're easier to raise in hatcheries than other strains of trout. Second of all, they're very hardy. They're hardier than many of the other strains of trout, so they could be introduced. They could withstand a higher temperature. And you can imagine that, you know, when they chopped down all the trees, that the temperature of the streams went up. Well, the rainbow trout can withstand a higher temperature than the brook trout. So they figured the rainbow trout were the fish to introduce. The brook trout were going to have to go because, once again, there's nobody was interested in regulating industry. So the brook trout would have to go, and they would have to find a fish that would withstand the conditions. And it turned out to be the rainbow trout. And now the other thing that the reason people really appreciate rainbow trout to this day, the fishermen, is because rainbow trout are really spectacular fighters. They, unlike most of the other trout, they'll jump in the air when you've got them on the hook. They'll fight hard. And if you go back to that notion that fishing reflects or builds your virility, you can imagine that you could extend that and say, well, then you need to find the best fighting prey. The better that your prey fights, the more that reflects on you and the more that's going to build your virility. So rainbow trout have become very popular both from the fisheries manager's point of view and from the fishing public. And it's gotten to the point now, by weight, rainbow trout are about 50% of the fish that are stocked in the streams every year. There's about 25 million pounds of rainbow trout that are stocked into fresh waters in the United States every year. That's about 100 million fish.
We have another caller here to talk with. Let's talk with them in Belgium, line four, right here. Hello.
Hello, and good morning
yes.
to you both. I wanted to get back to the introduction of the rainbow trout, and I may have my facts slightly wrong here, so bear with me. Up in southern Oregon, there's Crater Lake, which is a national park, and it's just spectacular national park. You drive up this mountain to about 10,000-12,000 feet, and on top of it, it's been chopped off, and you look down into a very large lake that's about 30 miles to drive around it, and you look down into this lake that's about 1,000 feet down. So you got this walk all the way down. And as I remember it, there weren't particularly any number of fish in there, and then they stocked rainbow trout into it, if I remember right. And now they have a concerted effort of anybody that wants to go there and is willing to walk a thousand foot trail down this very steep hillside to a place where there's only one boat that you can go out on to float around to fish for these things, but they want people to get rid of all these trout in this particular lake because it obviously wasn't indigenous there, and it was added, like you say, back turn of the century or something. Am I right with that?
I believe you are right. I think that Crater Lake, in fact, I don't think there were fish in Crater Lake originally, and then they stocked it with rainbow trout, as they did in so many other places. And then there was a real turn of... A turnaround in the national park. So there's been a turnaround in many places in terms of these rainbow trout. People have started to think, well, these fish have an incredible effect on the ecosystem. They not only on other animals in the water, amphibians, invertebrates, but also even on birds, for example, nearby who might normally eat the mayflies that hatch out of a lake, for example, that was barren of fish before. Well, if you put rainbow trout in there, then they eat up all the mayfly larvae while they're underwater, and then that ripples out into the ecosystem, into the birds and the bats and far and wide. So there's been an effort, and especially in the National Park Service, to actually start trying to remove these non-native fish. And that all took place, you know, as in with so many things in the 60s, the National Park Service philosophy really shifted from providing as much recreational opportunity as possible to actually trying to preserve whatever the native flora and fauna were in the parks a long time ago. So that's essentially what happened is Crater Lake was stocked with rainbows, as were so many other national parks. And then they had a real shift in philosophy. So I'm not surprised. I don't know that the answer to the last part of your question, whether they're actually encouraging people to catch the rainbows and keep them, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me.
I can attest to you that they do encourage you to take them.
Okay, so there you go.
You have to have an Oregon fishing license, but you can take all you want. The problem is, it's an effort to walk down to this thing. I mean, it's very steep, and it's very tenuous back and forth, just to get down to it. And I wondered, the Park Service had to fill this with fish so that somebody would make this extreme walk. It's just amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
And I'll tell you, I mean, even beyond that, there's amazing things that are going on in terms of removals. A lot of times they're turning to actually trying to poison the rainbows out. So they in Great Smokies, they got rid of the brook trout so that they could put in rainbow trout. And now just recently, the whole philosophy has changed, and they're actually trying to poison out the rainbows so that they can reintroduce the native brookies. So the National Park Service has been pushing hard. And it's actually become a really big deal in California. There's a couple of lawsuits right now against the California Department of Fish and Game that just hit the books in the last couple of weeks, where people are suing them because they don't believe the California Department of Fish and Game has paid sufficient attention to the environmental impacts of all of the fish that they've stocked over the years and continue to stock on a really massive scale. So it's become a really big deal today, what to do about these rainbows that we've spread so far and wide.
And apparently, even in a case, for example, like the case like the caller cites, where you had a remote lake where not only did they not have rainbow trout, they may not have had any fish at all. So it was deliberately stocked. That had a really serious effect on the local ecosystem. And you get a situation like that, though, that then it fills up with trout, and it's really actually not good for the trout either.
Well, yeah, that actually was an interesting point that they did some research in California. So in the high Sierra lakes in California, most of those were devoid of fish as well. The glaciers retreated 10,000 years ago, and there were barrier falls so that the fish never got up to these lakes. So this whole unique fauna evolved there, including these amphibians, mountain yellow-legged frogs. And this whole fauna developed there, and then they started stocking the high Sierra with all of the lakes with these fish, and it had this enormous impact on these frogs. It's driven the frogs close to extinction. And so they are now trying to get rid of them in any way that they can, but it's been extremely controversial.
Mm. We have another caller to talk with. We'll go to the next person, and that's someone in Geneva, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, that's my old stomping grounds, the Sierras. I used to work there. I worked in the Angeles National Forest and the Inyo National Forest. And I'm really familiar with the backcountry up there, Bishop and Lone Pine and Independence. I don't know if you're familiar with Black's Lake, Seven Lakes, Crowley Lake, all those. Crowley has a big fishing tournament for trout in the springtime. It's usually around May. And that lake is so stocked full of fish. And I always laughed into it, laughed at it because it was, you could literally almost walk across the lake. There's so many fish. But then at the end of the fishing tournament, it's devoid of fish. Because their limit is like 11 fish, I think, 11 or 12 fish at a time each day for each person. It's just nuts. But actually, that was my study, my field research. There's a couple of fish hatcheries within the forest up there, and they were at the time raising rainbow trouts. And, I mean, by the thousands, huge. And that's all you saw was rainbow trout. And actually, they were having problems with a canker or like a wart-type fungus on the fish. Now, I haven't been out there for years, so I don't know whatever happened to them. But, of course, when you work for the Forest Service, it's almost like you got to work for nothing. You got to like a job because you don't get paid a lot. So, but I love that place. It was great. I miss it. I really, living out here in the West, in the Midwest, you don't see any mountains. I kind of miss that. Kind of give you a little bit of direction, but. Anyway, I'll let you go. I just thought I'd kind of really bring it back old memories.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. The Sierras are stunningly beautiful. John Muir called them the range of light, and it's just the way the light bounces off the granite up high in the high country is it's one of the most gorgeous places on earth. And also you mentioned Crowley Reservoir, which is actually a really fascinating case study in rainbow trout management. So they've bred all of these different strains of rainbow trout. It all have different properties, and so they end up stocking multiple different strains into one water body to sort of take advantage of all the different properties. And in Crowley, I was talking to Curtis Milliron, who's a fish and game official out there. They stock three types of different rainbows into Crowley. There's the Kamloops trout, which are easily caught from the shore, but they don't live very long, so they provide a nice little fishery around the edge for people who are fishing from the shore. Then they stock these Coleman trout, which are deep water trout, and they're there for the trollers who like to get out in their boats. And then they stock these Eagle Lake rainbows, which survive for a long time and can provide a real sort of trophy trout fishery. So it's really the engineering, it really is engineering in many ways that they do to these fisheries is amazing.
Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I got an email here, and I don't know if this is contrary to the spirit, but someone says and I don't know how familiar you are with fishing in the Midwest, but they want to know where's the nearest place they can go to catch some rainbow trout.
I would guess almost everywhere, but I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the fishing areas in Illinois. But I'm sure that if you look online at any state or Indiana, any of the state fish and game departments, you'll quickly find instructions on where to go.
Yeah, and well, the Department of Natural Resources, I imagine, we'll probably be able to help you out. Well, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that I said earlier that there are a lot of really interesting characters connected with the story, and you talked about one of them, George Perkins Marsh. I think maybe if there's anyone who deserves the title of the father of the modern rainbow trout, in a sense, I guess that would be a man named Livingston Stone. Tell us about him.
Well, he was a fascinating character. So he was he traced his lineage all the way back to the Mayflower, and he grew up in a Boston family and became a minister in Charlestown, New Hampshire. And shortly around 1869, 1870, he decided he was going to he stopped being a minister and started a fish farm. This was in the early days of these fish farms. And before you know it, he was one of the pioneers in the whole technique. And before you know it, he got in touch with this man named Spencer Fullerton Baird, who was the head of the newly formed United States Fish Commission. And Baird sends him off in 1872 to Northern California, which truly was a remote wilderness at that point, and to start a fish hatchery. And it's one of the sort of most amazing stories I've ever seen. Here was this man who had grown up in a very sort of sheltered and protected life back east. And I just have to assume he just thirsted for some adventure. And so 3 years after they finished the Transcontinental Railroad, he was on it, steaming across the country. You know, you can imagine there were still buffalo herds and Indians, and he went across and went up to the Northern California on the McLeod River, where a group of Indians known as the Wintu, who had killed almost every settler that had tried to come into that area, were still living and still harvesting salmon. And his mission was to create a hatchery for Pacific salmon that they could send back to stock the eastern rivers where the Atlantic salmon had really disappeared. And he's a terrific writer. His works are online. If you look online for the U.S. Fish Commission reports, you can find them. He wrote these amazing descriptions of his adventures out there in this extremely remote and wild country. And he really sort of became a hero for me as I read this book. He was a fascinating, fascinating person.
And so as you explained, he went out there. The initial assignment was to start a salmon hatchery, but he found the rainbow trout there. And did he somehow, something about that fish made him think, whoa, this is the fish we ought to be working with?
Yeah, well, so there's a couple of interesting points there. First of all, the salmon, he shipped, you know, hundreds of thousands of salmon eggs back east, and they stocked them all up and down the East Coast, and not one of them took. So they never managed to establish Pacific salmon on the East Coast. And so they were beginning to become aware that this just wasn't working. It was a failure. And, you know, who knows what was going through their mind, but they did know at the same time there were sort of two emphases to this U.S. Fish Commission, which was the new body in charge of propagating fish. One was this utilitarian aspect. They wanted to create food fish for people. But the other was recreation. They really wanted to create, they knew that many of the most powerful constituents in Congress were sport fishermen, and they knew they needed to satisfy them. And they found these rainbow trout, and it became the mission, was to propagate this sport fish instead of the Pacific salmon that he had originally gone out there for. And then, the adventures, speaking of characters and adventures, I mean, it goes on. There's one of the most amazing stories, I think, out of this book is the 1962 poisoning of the Green River. There were a number of different fascinating people involved. So in 1962, the Wyoming Game and Fish Department and Utah Fish and Game and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decided they wanted to poison out all of the native and wild fish in the Green River above Flaming Gorge. So that's a watershed of about 15,000 square miles. It's about the size of Connecticut and Massachusetts combined. They decided to poison out all of the native fish in that watershed so that they could make it safe to stock rainbow trout. And it was an amazing story, and there were some amazing characters involved in that, including a man named Robert Miller, who was a biologist who had sort of one of the first ones to really care about native fish. And he tried to fight this thing, and didn't succeed in blocking it. In fact, had very little luck even getting it publicized. There were almost no newspaper articles about it. But after the fact, some of these fish were killed down in Dinosaur National Monument, and it became a huge controversy. And it led to the creation of a committee called the Committee on Rare and Threatened Species in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and ultimately to the Endangered Species Act that we have today, so that now, ironically, in some ways because of this amazing poisoning project to kill the native fish in the Green River, we've now spent more than $100 million trying to restore some of the native fish that we were poisoning out 45 years ago.
Yeah, it just is incredible. Yeah. Let's talk with some other folks here. Urbana, line one, right here. Hello.
Hello. A couple of questions. You brought up the salmon matter. The modern farm-raised salmon, those are the Atlantic strain, aren't they? Or do they use both?
There's both.
Both, okay. Yep. And the other is, here in the Midwest, I think in the East generally, there were, they introduced brown trout, which I believe are a European strain, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And yes, those have been widely introduced as well.
Have they resulted in many of the same problems?
They have resulted in many of the same problems. One of the biggest threats from the rainbow trout, however, is that they can hybridize with mm-hmm. cutthroat trout, so which the brown trout can't do. They're a different genus. So the rainbow trout have actually really decimated most of the native cutthroat in the West because they hybridize them out of existence, and it becomes this sort of mongrel species. The other reason browns haven't been aren't discussed quite as much, although they're still very widespread, as you probably know, is because simply that the rainbows are easier to raise in the hatcheries and more popular as a fighting fish. Brown trouts tend to be a little bit more reclusive, much harder to catch,
mm-hmm.
And so they're not quite as popular with the fisheries managers. And so the rainbow trout, like I say, you know, the 100 million rainbows are stocked every year. They are the fish that are stocked. Browns tend to, if you catch a brown, they tend to be a wild fish, not something that the Fish and Game Department has stocked.
The native brook trout was the only native trout here in the East, wasn't it?
Yes.
And is it hanging on at all, or is it somewhat endangered?
Oh, no, they're doing fine, and they're actually recovering quite nicely.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases trying to get rid of rainbow trout now to bring back the brook trout. So they're actually doing just fine. They're not one of the fish that our people are overly concerned with.
They are smaller fish, aren't they?
Well, it all depends. They do tend to do very well in sort of smaller water bodies compared to some of these other fish. So they can be, they frequently, when you catch them, you'll find lots of small brook trout. But they can be large, beautiful fish, and there's nothing more beautiful than a big brook trout in spawning colors, except maybe a cutthroat in spawning colors. But they you can find big ones.
Oh, I didn't realize they did get large. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of focus. Just before going on to another caller, let me quickly introduce our guest, Anders Halvorsen. He's a journalist. He is the author of the book, An Entirely Synthetic Fish, How Rainbow Trout Beguiled America and Overran the World. It's published by the Yale University Press. He wrote this book with support from the National Science Foundation. He wrote it as a research associate at the University of Colorado's Center of the American West. And so if you're interested in reading the book, you can head out to the bookstore. And here, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You may email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. On next to another caller, this is someone in Champaign and line two. Hello.
Yes, hi. I just have a quick comment. This is, again, another story that shows how, you know, some large federal organizations such as Fish and Wildlife, who are funded, you know, by taxpayer dollars, have always catered to special interest groups, in this case, hunters and fishermen, and in the process have done, you know, tremendous amounts of ecological damage, with programs like, you know, extermination of large predators like coyotes and wolves, and, you know, putting in these kind of fish that are non-native. And I find this story interesting because I think it's something that so many people in the American public are not aware of, is how much some of these ecological problems we have are actually the root cause has been programs initiated by the federal government. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
All right. Thank you. You want to respond to that?
Sure. I mean, it is quite fascinating. And in many ways, a lot of these agencies have a very split personality. So like I was saying about the Green River episode, I mean, it's pretty stunning that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is now in charge of the Endangered Species Act, at that time was in charge of poisoning out these fish, these natives. And you see that all over the country in many of these fish and game departments. You know, in California, you had they were stocking these rainbow trout and other varieties of trout all over the state for many years, and now you've got that same agency that was stocking these fish trying to remove them from some of the very lakes that they were stocking them into 10 years earlier. So in a lot of these agencies, you have a real split personality, and the same goes for the Fish and Wildlife Service. They operate an enormous number of hatcheries where they raise rainbow trout to put into these streams, and yet at the same time, they are in charge of administering the Endangered Species Act, so they've got other biologists on board who are working in just the opposite direction. So it is a fascinating situation. The one thing to remember, especially with not so much with the Fish and Wildlife Service, but with the state fish and game agencies, is they derive most, if not all, of their income or their budget from selling fishing and hunting licenses. So there's an incentive in these agencies to provide as much fishing and hunting as possible. And now they're being put in charge many times of managing non-game species, which creates a real conflict because you have a lot of the sport fishermen and hunters who feel like they are the ones funding these agencies, and yet the agencies are doing much more than just managing hunting and fishing. So there's a lot of interesting conflicts going on within the agencies themselves right now.
Yeah. Well, I think part of your purpose in writing the book is to suggest that here that points to the kind of conflicts that we have in the way that we think about nature and the environment. And is it something that should be exploited or something that should be protected? And what do you even mean by those words? And, you know, what's the place of humans? And do they have a place? We really are, and if you look at what we do as individuals and what government does, it makes it look like we're really very confused.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd like to give us more credit than, I guess, than being confused. I mean, it's a difficult situation, and it's a difficult question. What is our place in the natural world? I don't think we're ever going to resolve that, but that is exactly what I was writing this book about. And what I found when I was working as a biologist myself and in grad school was that there was a lot of – most of the conflicts that you hear about when people discuss them, it's either the technicalities of the science or the law, and that's what everyone is discussing and arguing and debating. But it occurred to me that there's actually something much deeper going on there. There's some much deeper values that are really driving the debate, and that people will have a position, and then they'll search for the science or the law to justify it. But very few people are talking about the values themselves, and that's really what I wanted to explore with this book, is where did these values come from? And what I found was just this fascinating story of these values that go back so deeply into our national consciousness and culture.
Again, we have about maybe 5-6 minutes left in this hour with Anders Halvorsen. The book, if you'd like to read it, is An Entirely Synthetic Fish, How Rainbow Trout Beguiled America and Overran the World. Yale University Press is the publisher. And that maybe we should mention that the title, this is a quote, I think, that comes from someone, and I think that this was somebody in the government, and it was a boast. It was something that was very positive, saying that in fact that because they had the technology that they would have had at the time, and I think this is a quote that actually comes out of the 30s, was that they were saying this is a good thing that we have progressed to the point where we could produce an entirely synthetic fish.
Yeah, that's right. And I've had a lot of pushback from people on that title. I think people are afraid that those are my words, and I was really going on a rampage against these fish, and that was really not what the title is about. The title is a quote from 1939 from the man who was in charge of the federal fish hatcheries. And like you say, he was very proud of the fact that they were able to create this entirely synthetic fish. And so I chose the title really to reflect, to say a lot more about us than it does about the fish themselves and how we've approached the world, whether we've looked for sort of technological fixes or more deeper approaches to solving our problems.
Given the fact that the rainbow, they did start with a native species, something that did indeed, though, have this much more limited range than it does now. And given that at the time, they had whatever breeding technology there was no genetic engineering, and we didn't even know about DNA then. Did they do things deliberately to try to encourage those characteristics in the fish that they really wanted, or was it that they saw something that already had the characteristics that they wanted, and what they were just doing was doing what they could do to reproduce it in large numbers?
Yeah, that's right. Up until very recently, it was selective breeding, which still is an extremely powerful tool. Of course, all of our domestic species, our domestic agricultural species have been selectively bred really to become what they are. So it's a very powerful tool. But that's what they were doing. They would find traits that they really wanted, and they would breed the fish that they wanted to get these traits. And sometimes they would have actually unintentional results. They would end up breeding fish that actually were very suited to growing in a hatchery, but were terribly suited to being in a river or a stream. So in some cases they would get fish, and it's a very difficult problem to overcome. If you're going to raise them in a hatchery, you're going to automatically select for fish that are suited for hatcheries, which means they'll be aggressive. They will, in many cases, not be afraid of a shadow. A wild fish will be terrified of a shadow coming over the water because it's usually a predator coming down to get it. To the hatchery-bred fish, a shadow usually means a hatchery worker coming in with some pellets to feed them. And then more recently, it's funny, some of the things that have been done. There's some University of Missouri researchers who have been feeding their rainbow trout creatine, which is the same supplement that Mark McGuire used. I guess he more recently admitted to using other things, but used to build up his muscles for the home run derby. They've been feeding the fish creatine so that they'll have these sort of super fighting fish for people to go out and catch.
Fish doping.
Yeah, exactly. So it's amazing. It's amazing the things that have been done for these fish.
Mm-hmm. When we're coming down to the last couple of minutes here, we do have another caller. Let's talk with them in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. A moment ago, a caller came in and raised the point that government agencies have not had a sterling record in fish management and other wildlife matters. But I'd like to point out that this isn't only a matter of government agencies, that it's largely a matter of introduced species, and that a very large percentage of the introduced species were introduced by private individuals. And I think it's only recently that we're beginning to understand the significance of this. And I think the Fish and Wildlife Agency does deserve some credit for having recognized this and now moving to help overcome the problem. It includes plants as well as fish and animals. The kudzu, for instance, which was introduced by the government, is now a major problem.
Yeah, that's right, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a national thing, and it goes again back to the 19th century where we had this acclimatizing movement where everybody was trying to introduce species as wide and far as they could. In fact, my favorite one is that there was a captain of industry from New York who felt that Americans were going to be culturally impoverished unless we had every bird that was present in Shakespeare over here in North America. And so because there was a line in Henry IV about starling, just one line, he brought starlings over, and now, of course, we have starlings across the country in enormous abundance, and that's all because it's mentioned in Henry IV and Shakespeare. So absolutely. Private individuals have been introducing species for a long time, and they still are. And you're right. Plants are big ones. We've got birds. We've got fish. And they get over for many different reasons. Ornamentals, Shakespeare, food, you name it. People have been bringing it in for a long time, and it is a big problem.
Yeah. I want to just, though, here's a story that I think is really great, and perhaps it does, though, get back to an illustration of what government did to propagate these fish and to move them around, because they were interested in getting them into remote places that were difficult to get to, and that among the advantages that the fish had, not only were they good fighters, but they seemed to be actually fairly robust. Could reproduce well and quickly, could live in various situations. But because they were trying to put them into places that were really difficult to get to, they actually dropped them out of airplanes. I love this story. So I guess they were going to someplace, some very remote body of water, and the easiest thing to do was just to fly over it in a plane and dump the fish out. And actually, the fish, enough of the fish managed to survive so that that was a technique that was used in a number of places.
And still is, quite commonly. It's a very common way to stock fish all over the country still. But yeah, that is a fascinating story. You know, it came out of the end of World War II. We had a lot of surplus military aircraft sitting around. We had a lot of bomber pilots around, and we had a real sort of can-do attitude. And these guys, it started in California, really just decided, hey, what happens if we try dropping these fish out of our plane? And they did all sorts of crazy things. The first one, they tried dropping them out inside a milk can, and they missed the pond they were shooting at. So it hit the rocks on the side and bounced along. And when they landed and went and looked inside the can, they found some living fish still swimming around in there. So they decided if they could survive that, they could probably survive anything. And they started dropping them out of these planes, and it became a really massive industry. One of the most common ways, in fact, to stock fish in the high country.
Yeah. And do I remember some story about somebody driving along in their car holding the fish out the window?
Well, right. So once they determined that the fish could survive in a can and being dropped inside water, they wanted to know if they could survive if they just dropped them through the air. So, yeah, so they gunned the engine down the hatchery road while one of them held the fish up in the air for a couple of minutes, and then they would bring it back down and look at this fish and see if it was still alive. And sure enough, the fish were doing just fine. So they decided it was a go, and they started dropping them. Mm-hmm. And they didn't restrict themselves to fish. I mean, they dropped turkeys and beaver and you name it. They dropped them. So it was quite an experiment.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to finish. It's a really interesting story, and I guess again, sort of the bottom line is that the idea is that you're encouraging people to think about the unintended consequences of actions and how it is that it sometimes something might seem like a good idea, or you might at least have good reasons for doing it, but that down the road you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, that sums it up well. And I think that the lessons we can take from how we've managed this fish can be extended to any number of other environmental issues that we're facing these days.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Anders Halvorsen. He's an award-winning journalist, has PhD in ecology from Yale. Currently, he's a research associate at the University of Colorado's Center of the American West. He was awarded a grant from the National Science Foundation to support the research and writing of the book. And if you'd like to read it, it is An Entirely Synthetic Fish, How Rainbow Trout Beguiled America and Overran the World, published by Yale University Press. Again, by our guest, Anders Halvorsen. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for listening.
Support for WILL comes from the College Illinois 529 Prepaid Tuition Program, the tax-advantaged plan that shields families from tuition inflation by allowing them to lock in prices now at colleges. More information can be found at 529prepaidtuition.org. The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system. This has been a test of the emergency alert system. This is WILL Urbana.
And it's 11:59, and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Tom Rogers, sitting in for Celeste Quinn today. Coming up in the 1 o'clock hour, an archive interview that Celeste did with Aaliyah Malik, a civil rights lawyer and journalist, author of the book A Country Called Amrika, Arab Roots, American Stories. That's coming up at 1:06 this afternoon. Commodities look like this. The wheat not being able to be supported by short covering, and there's some word of record crops, or at least bumper crops, that are bringing the wheat down. The May wheat contract in Kansas City is down a half penny at 476 and a quarter. The May in Chicago.